3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders, past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh yeah.
Alternative news, analysis and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your pants.
Good morning, listeners. You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show here on 3CR, 855 AM on the dial, which just passed its 50th birthday. I'm Rob, and for the next 90 minutes, we'll be bringing you some current affairs from across the world of the radical left. Hope everyone is staying warm. This morning, it is absolutely, it's almost freezing. You are obviously just listening to Think Again, brought to you by the Borderlands Collective here at 3CR, which obviously airs every Friday at 10 to 10:30 a.m. and also before our show at 6 to 6:30. So thank you to the folks at Think Again for a wonderful show as always. On today's show, we're going to be spending a little bit of time in the archives, but before that, we are going to be speaking with Mark Meager, who is actually going to be joining us in the studio despite it being very, very cold. Mark Meager was an early presenter of the Gay Liberation Program here on 3CR from 1978 to 1985, as well as a member of 3CR's management committee and vice chairperson of the Community Radio Federation. So we'll be speaking about his involvement at 3CR and the state of the gay political scene here in the 80s. So that's probably happening just after our headlines in about 10 minutes' time. And then following that, Mark has actually gifted us with some archival audio from the 19th of September, 1979. It's from the Gay Liberation Program, in which Mark is speaking with Grant, Dave, and a young Alison Thorne of Thorne Harbour Health. And they were all a part of this group called Young Gays. And they're just speaking about being young and gay, and they're also speaking about differences in attitudes between young queer people and their sort of outer counterparts, I guess, as well as building solidarity in the queer community. And there's also a really interesting part of that show, which we're going to be airing later, which talks about how these three people approached coming out to their parents in the 70s, which is super interesting. And as with many of the other audio that we've aired from the Gay Liberation Program over the last couple of weeks or months, the parallels between queer people then and queer people now are very similar. So we'll be airing that archival audio at around 7:40, I would say, 7:40 or 7:35. And it'll go up until about 8 o'clock. And then just after 8, we'll be joined by Tom Cooper, who is a resident of the Inkerman Street public housing flats in St. Kilda, who is part of a group of people who, residents of these buildings, which have taken it upon themselves to start spraying pest control in their own buildings because they're sick of waiting for the Victorian government to take action and start spraying pest control in buildings that they're meant to be maintaining. And I think that's a really important issue, right? Because it just highlights yet again how ridiculous it is, like how neglected these buildings have become because the government refuses to look after them, right? Like, even with all of the public housing towers that they're knocking down, there is evidence to show that they could have been refurbished this whole entire time, but the Victorian government has just refused to maintain them over the last couple of decades, and instead they're choosing to rebuild the buildings under a private name. You know, this is a very neoliberal policy. Anyway, you're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show here on 3CR 855 AM. Hope everyone who attended 3CR's birthday party on Saturday had a good time. I had a blast. It was so amazing to see so many faces, and yeah, of course, with radio, it's really nice to put a face to the voice that you listen to. So yeah, and also a quick shout out to the Yarra Bug Show who repaired my bike at the party. Yeah, I was in desperate need of a new tube, and I actually brought the wrong tube with me to get my bike repaired, and they were very, very helpful in that they just had the right tube on them. So yeah, absolutely shout out to the Yarra Bug Show, which airs later this morning at 10 AM. But for now, 10:30, my mistake. But for now, let's get into our headlines.
Some folks know about it, some don't. Some will learn to shout it, some won't. But sooner or later, baby, here's a ditty. Say you're gonna have to get right down to the real nitty gritty. Let's get right down to the real nitty gritty now. One, two, nitty gritty now, yeah.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM on the dial. These are the news headlines for Monday, the 6th of July, 2026. Last week, the Albanese government rejected a majority of recommendations made in the UN Human Rights Council's Universal Periodic Review. The UN Human Rights Council conducts its Universal Periodic Review every 4 years for each member state. Some 332 recommendations were made, with 204 being rejected by the federal government. Among the recommendations rejected were the call to raise the age of criminal responsibility, which in some parts of the continent is as low as 10 years old, ending mandatory and offshore immigration detention, ratifying international human rights treaties, and removing legal exemptions which make way for queer people to be discriminated against within the law. In terms of Indigenous people's rights, the recommendations that were accepted were those which aligned with legislation already passed here in the colony, such as the government's Closing the Gaps targets and their commitment to addressing overrepresentation of Indigenous people in prison. Just 4 of the Closing the Gaps goals are currently on track to be met, according to the Productivity Commission. And in terms of addressing the overrepresentation of Indigenous people in jails across the continent, the Australian Human Rights Commission has said that Indigenous people are 15 times more likely to be incarcerated in 2026, and the rate of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children between the ages of 10 and 17 in detention on an average day is 26 times that of non-Indigenous children. Catherine Eacock, co-chair of the Indigenous People's Organisation Australia, said the organisation is, quote, disappointed to see the Australian government refuse to implement the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, end quote. Especially given the declaration was endorsed by the Australian government back in 2009. Catherine Eacock also said that the consequences of Australia's refusal to implement the declaration are, quote, concrete. Closing the gap keeps failing because of the government's failure to effectively engage Indigenous peoples in decision-making on issues impacting them, end quote. A problem that will not be solved unless that changes. In other news this week, Donald Trump made over $2.2 billion in the first year of his second term, a mandatory financial disclosure report revealed on Tuesday last week. Some $1.4 billion were attributed to profits from cryptocurrencies associated with the president, including $635 million from the Trump-branded crypto meme coin, and another $590 million from World Liberty Financial, a crypto business owned by the Trump family. When asked about his earnings while in office, Trump stated that it was because the, quote, stock market is going up, everybody's profiting, end quote, while glossing over the estimated two-thirds of investors in Trump's meme cryptocurrency coin, which have reportedly lost money as the president's wallet grows. Ironically, he made the announcement standing in front of the new Air Force One, a Boeing 747 gifted to him by the Qatari royal family, which costs something like $400 million, a gift he plans to keep after his presidency and raising questions about the state of U.S. foreign affairs. And finally, in the news this week, The Age is reporting that a sweep of former Liberal Party donors are now sending their money to Pauline Hanson's One Nation ahead of the Victorian state election in November. Property developers have reportedly offered large amounts of money to One Nation in return for the party's reversal of the Allan government's property taxes. Business owners have similarly pledged their funds to One Nation in hopes the party would revoke legislation of small businesses and the state's work-from-home policy. The Age reports that despite the rumoured rise in the number of donors, not much is known about exactly who is donating, with only two donations disclosed to Victoria's Election Commission. 3CR listeners may recall a recent One Nation fundraiser event, which was forced to be rescheduled at the last minute due to a community counter protest 3 weeks ago. Tickets to the event cost between $200 and $2,000, with both Pauline Hanson and Barnaby Joyce in attendance. However, due to pressure from protesters outside the venue, the pair were both unable to hold a presser in peace and were forced to leave through the back entrance, a stark reminder that those opposed to fascism must mobilize as monetary support for One Nation increases. These have been the news headlines for Monday, the 6th of July. You're listening to 3CR on 855 AM. This fascist group thing, evil men with racist views, spreading all across the land. They're pulling on the boots in Brazil and wiping off the eggshells in Moorabbin. Fascism's on the march, and we say, yeah, nah.
Yena Pasaran is a new weekly program on 3CR dedicated to tracking this rise in Australia, Aotearoa, and all around our increasingly warm little globe.
Every Thursday at 4:30 PM, we'll be talking to writers and fighters about some angry blighters.
Every day, people in prisons across Australia are subjected to strip searching. It is an unnecessary, degrading, and deeply harmful practice that must end. It involves a person literally being stripped of their dignity, forced to remove their clothing for their bodies to be inspected by prison guards, being forced to submit to humiliating requests like bending, squatting, and spreading their legs. In many prisons, people are subjected to this repeatedly and routinely. Children as young as 10 years old are being forced to remove their clothes and have their bodies inspected by adults. We're calling on the federal government to stop state-sanctioned violence by ending the routine, unregulated use of strip searching in prisons across Australia. Go to endstripsearching.com. Together, we can demand a system that upholds dignity, safety, and human rights. Fig Jam is a 3CR supporter.
Tune in to the Beyond the Bars prison broadcast during NAIDOC Week 2026. Listen to 3CR each weekday at 11 a.m. from Monday the 6th through to Friday the 10th of July. We'll take you inside six Victorian prisons: Dame Phyllis Frost Centre, Barwon Prison, Fulham Correctional Centre, Loddon Prison, Marganeet Correctional Centre, and Western Plains Correctional Centre. There'll be stories, songs, opinions, and poems from the men and women inside while connecting with culture and community. The shows will be live on 3CR 855 on your AM dial, 3CR Digital, and streaming via our website or the Community Radio Plus app. Head to 3cr.org.au/beyondthebars2026 for more information.
This country's black future is a fire.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show here on 3CR Community Radio. Definitely check out 3CR's Beyond the Bars broadcasts, which start today and for the entirety of NAIDOC Week from 11 a.m. You can catch us on 855 a.m. on the dial, streaming live at 3cr.org.au, and also on the Community Radio Plus app, which is actually my favourite place to listen to 3CR because you can just listen to it all the time, wherever you go. Anyway, we are now joined in the studio by Mark Meager, early presenter of the Gay Liberation Program from 1978 to 1985. Mark was also a member of the 3CR Management Committee and a vice chairperson of the Community Radio Federation, and we'll be speaking about his involvement at 3CR and the state of the gay political scene here in so-called Melbourne during the 80s. So why don't you start, Mark, by telling me how you became to be involved in the Gay Liberation Radio Collective and 3CR itself?
Right. Well, I'm trying to stretch my memory going back, well, we're talking about, 48 years. You get a bit fuzzy with time. But I came out as gay in January 1978 and got involved with Gay Lib, and people in Gay Lib that I knew were producing the program. Late Ian Molloy, Rob Broughton, as he calls himself nowadays, and others. I got involved with the Gay Liberation Radio Collective producing Gay Lib programs from early 1978. I think you've just said that you found an early copy of a program that I did back then. And I did the programs as part of the Gay Liberation Radio Collective for a number of years, I think probably through until 85, 86. I was involved in other things with gay organisations. Gay Liberation was one. I ended up being the treasurer of Gay Liberation in its dying days. And in fact, when Gay Liberation stopped meeting, it was agreed that the Gay Liberation Radio Collective would continue on. And the Gay Liberation was one of the founding members of the Community Radio Federation in 76 and produced Gay Liberation programs from 1976 when 3CR started for many years. It was one of the first gay programs, I think, in the world possibly, but certainly in Australia.
And how did you see the show change throughout your time at 3CR?
Well, I think that the show probably didn't change that much. We tried to. Sometimes the production was... it was very much, if nobody else was prepared to do the program, I ended up doing it. So sometimes you're cobbling together stuff at late notice. There wasn't a large group involved, so it wasn't always some of the polished production that you see with some of the other gay programs. Sometimes it was playing music and talking about issues at the time and telling people what was on. Listening back to some of the programs, they seem a bit lame to me now, but at the time, telling people what was on and when it was on was actually probably filling quite an important social function because we didn't have social media at the time. We didn't have mobile phones. We couldn't text each other. We had to sort of ring each other up on phones. And as I was saying to you at the time, if you rang anybody from 3CR's phone, ASIO was probably listening, or if not ASIO, Special Branch. So
maybe they wanted to go to these gay events.
I don't know. The ASIO didn't seem to keep records on the gay things, but I'm pretty sure the Victorian Special Branch that was located here in Fitzroy did keep tabs on the on gay organisations at the time.
Yeah.
That came to light when the arrest took place in Sydney at the first Sydney Mardi Gras in 1978. We helped organise a demonstration against the arrests a week or two later in Melbourne. And the police contacted us, contacted GayLib to say, we know you're doing a demonstration, we want to meet to talk with you about the route that you're going to take. So we had this chap from he claimed to be from the Russell Street traffic branch, but he arrived on foot, and we knew at the time that Special Branch was located just around the corner at the side of the Fitzroy Town Hall. So we're a little bit suspicious. I don't know whether I should be mentioning his name. You can cut this if you like. His name was Tricker, but I suspect it might have been T-R-I-C-A, who was a well-known Melbourne policeman at the time. I can remember him asking about Eureka flag colours, and I made a joke about, at the time, 3CR was going through some conniptions, and there were red Eureka and blue Eureka. Flag-associated people with the station. I made a joke about there being a purple polka-dotted Eureka flag, and was taken quite seriously. I thought, oh, no, he's taking notes. But we organised the demo, and then I went up to Sydney for the 4th National Conference.
The 4th National Conference of...
Homosexuals, and I think it was 4th National Homosexual Conference it was called in those days. We organised the next one in Melbourne, which I think was a conference of homosexuals and lesbians. The name's changed. It's become more inclusive over time. But, of course, when going up to Sydney then was when there were still arrests being made of people, and one of the things, a large number of people arrested, including one of the programmers for the Gay Lib program at the time, who was arrested. He was with me, and he was marching. He was dancing along gaily, and I was saying, no, no, come in and stay in, because I could see that things weren't... shaping up too well with the way the police were behaving. Well, I had a bit of demo sense, and he ended up in the cells at Darlinghurst, which is now the Qtopia Museum, but he's still around. But a number of people from those days, unfortunately, are no longer with us. But
So before our interview, I obviously gave you a tour of the space, 3CR as a space. Maybe you'd like to talk about what is physically different compared to when you were last here.
Well, it hasn't changed too much, and it's been many, many years since I've last been in at 3CR. The desk that you're sitting in front of, I could possibly operate myself. I haven't done digital programming. In the day when we wanted to edit a program, And I used to do the station duty work at 3CR, which was vetting programs. And if we had to, we'd get a block, an aluminium block out. We'd get the tape. We'd cut the tape. We could cut a word out without you noticing, and then tape the tape back together again with tape, and that would be the way of editing. Of course, it's all done digitally nowadays, but I've still got an editing block at home that I used to use for stringing together programs at home on my open reel.
The Gay Liberation Show was potentially or definitely Australia's first gay radio program.
Yep.
I'm curious to know if other collectives from across Australia or even internationally sort of reached out to Gay Lib to sort of help with guidance.
Well, there were other groups. Ian, who was involved in the Gay Lib program in the early days, went on to Canberra. Oh. And was involved with 2XX in Canberra, which is a community station in Canberra, and they presented a gay program. I can remember going up there for their first gay day, which they spent 24 hours of gay programming. And,
what year was that?
Oh, I'm not sure of the year now. I'd have to research that. My memory remembers the event, not the precise details at this distance. And so I can remember, I certainly remember it because it started early in the morning and it was an early Canberra morning at -8 degrees. Getting to the station in a combi van with no heating and having to have the windows down was something that I will never forget.
For
the
sure.
date, however, yeah.
Yeah. You know it's cold and that was it.
Mm.
So talk to me about the state of political activism within the gay and lesbian community. Here in Melbourne during the 80s and the 70s as well.
Oh, there was quite a lot of political activism. There were women associated with the Women's Lib movement. I have one of the things we did record, and I've still got some of the tapes. I think I've given some of them to the Gay Archives, or the Queer Archives, as it's called nowadays. I've given them tapes of national homosexual conferences. So we taped a lot of the plenary sessions of the national homosexual conferences, which probably would make interesting reading or interesting listening if you want that sort of thing with the various politics. I mean, within the gay movement, there were people who were sort of socially progressive but somewhat conservative. There were people who were quite progressive, and there were differences between the two. I mean, we had women who didn't particularly want to associate with gay men. We had women who wanted to associate with gay men. We didn't have, I mean, we certainly associated with transsexual people, but it wasn't as big a focus as it is nowadays.
Yeah, I think somehow the political identity of being queer has come to form, including trans people, which is a really interesting evolution.
Well, certainly there's that sort of that more inclusive political. I mean, there used to be women who would argue about men being sexist, and there were lesbian households in Melbourne where men weren't welcome because they were men. But nevertheless, some of them did still participate in the gay movement. So there could be interesting dynamics going on.
Did you change the name of the because the Gay Liberation Program, did it include like lesbians were hosting it, right?
Yeah.
So did you change, was the name changed to the Gay and Lesbian
Liberation
Show?
You know, that's a funny question when you think about it, because at the time, gay to us meant same-sex attracted.
I see.
It didn't mean men.
Right.
And I would never describe myself as a gay. I would always describe myself as a gay man.
Right.
And a lesbian's a gay woman. From my perspective, the term gay is inclusive. And
Sorry, that's my bad with the vernacular.
Well,
Yep.
Well, now we use queer, to try and use that inclusive term. I mean, I feel a bit funny about being queer, but and that's a joke. we looked at it as being, and the women then wanted to be more identified, so we did include lesbian in the names of things. So it's a progression till we've got what is sometimes referred to as the alphabet soup nowadays, which doesn't exactly roll off the tongue.
Uh-huh.
Queer, possibly, or even gay would be a better thing in my view.
I'll just remind our listeners that you're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM, previously 840.
And 837.
And 830 kilohertz.
In fact, your phone number, I think, is still 94198377. So.
And I'm here in the studio speaking with Mark Meagher, who is an early presenter of the Gay Liberation Program from 1978 to around 1985, as well as a member of the 3CR's Management Committee and Vice Chairperson of the Community Radio Federation.
It's interesting to sort of, sometimes we don't really, I'm in my 70s now, you don't realise what the young people don't appreciate. And certainly when it comes to history, that sort of thing, you don't appreciate the history.
I mean, I think it's super important. I mean, I'm 27.
Mm.
I think it's pretty important, especially politically, as a, like a capital Q queer person, right, politically to be... to know the history.
When I came out in 78, it was a political statement to say, I am gay, I am here, and I am proud.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very much what gay liberation was about freeing yourself from the oppression that had gone on in the past. Mm. And simply saying that you were gay and you were proud and you weren't going to be put down, that was very strongly political in the time.
Absolutely political.
I mean, there were other things that people were involved with. I mean, unfortunately, in the 80s, AIDS came along, and there was lots of activism directed in towards AIDS. Unfortunately, too many people died as a result of that.
So did you find that, and I have this experience now, but did you find that there were people who were, how do I describe it, as like lowercase g gay, who are just like gay in a sense of sexuality, versus people who are gay and like yourself, who are capital G gay in a political sense as well, who like wore it as a political identity?
I mean, there were people who were happy to sleep with you but didn't want to be known as gay.
Yeah.
In fact, I could talk about the sad thing about it. And I didn't meet him through 3CR, but he was actually one of the early station workers here at 3CR, who was an avid 78 record collector. And I did meet him. I think I probably met him at a sauna. And so we had a bit of an affair. And I can remember running into him here at 3CR, and he was sort of quite... And I knew he was a bit closeted, but he was quite... he didn't particularly want to be identified, I think, and unfortunately he was murdered. That was a time when the gay men were murdered quite often. He was murdered. I went home one day and turned on the TV, and lo and behold, there's the inside of his flat on the TV and talking about a murder. And that's happened recently too. I turned on the TV and seen somebody's house and they've been murdered. So it still goes on, but that was quite horrible at the time. And there were lots, I mean, they talk about the Sydney gay murders with people being pushed off a cliff at Bondi, but there were gay murders that were happening here at Beats and that sort of thing. I mean, I can recall murders taking place in, I think, Johnson Park in Geelong. Possibly elsewhere, and I don't think that would have been all collated. Certainly the police weren't interested in collating details of poofters that were sort of taken out of the scene. I mean, it was illegal in those days. In fact, preparing today, I went through my tub of archival material and I pulled out drafts and copies of the Hansard of the Victorian Sexual Offences Act that was enabled that when male homosexuality was decriminalised here in Victoria. And, you know, strangely, here in Victoria at the time, the gay law reform went through under a Liberal government. I don't think it would happen with the mob that are running around nowadays.
Yeah. I mean, it's quite ironic to think about, you know, I mean, especially with the Labour being in power in so much of the country, and yet they're leading the blocking of access for gender-affirming care for trans youth. You know, like they're on the front lines of blocking this stuff.
Right. Well,
these days, you know.
I haven't quite followed everything in detail there with that. I mean, I do look at with alarm with some of this sort of anti-trans stuff that's coming out. I mean, I don't know. I mean, when do you decide your gender? It's not something I've had to face. I had to decide my sexuality, which I think is possibly different.
Yeah. There's just something kind of creepy to me about the government deciding, no, you cannot do this. You cannot identify as trans and you cannot do this with your body.
Yeah, well, that's very much the whole thing with gay liberation, telling us that it was only good to have sex.
Yeah. So how did the gay liberation show and also 3CR in particular sort of fit into the activism for gay liberation here in Melbourne?
How did 3CR? Well, 3CR had a long history of activism. There were all sorts of people on the left associated with 3CR. I mean, you could have all sorts of people that I've met through 3CR over the years. I mean, from people who went on to become governor generals to people who, as I said to you, 3CR was licensed by the Labor government, the Whitlam Labor government. I can remember sitting in the studio one day, and Moss Cass, who was the Minister for Communications in the Labor government that gave 3CR the license, wandered in. This is after, unfortunately, the Labor government had been sacked, and sat down and had a chat in the studio, but didn't want to go on air. But you know, we had particularly the left unions, the Food Preservers Union, and Friends of the Earth, Movement Against Uranium Mining. The Community Radio Federation is a large group of people. I'm not sure whether who's on the Community Radio Federation nowadays. I mean, with members. Do you have a listing? I mean, there used to be about 150 different community organisations. And the whole idea of 3CR in the early days was to give access to people that were denied access in the mainstream media. Mm-hmm. So, and I would suspect that it's possibly still that. And playing a bit of Australian content.
I mean, we play at least 51% of Australian music.
Right.
Which is becoming more and more important as mainstream radios just like play. I don't know. Sometimes I listen to radios like on construction sites at work, and it's just like, okay, here's another song from Taylor Swift. You know, that kind of thing. So I think 3CR is really important in that kind of sense. Yeah, so obviously you mentioned before that, I mean, you helped out with a gay radio program in Canberra.
There was also Gay Waves in Sydney. The Gay Radio Information Service, News Service, provided us with cassettes with news that they would compile news. Mm-hmm. We went and got gay publications from around the world to try and get gay news, to sort of work out what was going on and provide gay news service.
There were many organisations giving back, like sending content back? Or just news?
We often get them from various gay newspapers around the world, such as sort of The Body Politic in Canada, Gay News in England, various news things in the USA. In fact, looking through stuff before I came in today, and I didn't really get a chance to sit down and compile them, I just happened to dig out something that I thought, oh, it was the Hirschfeld Centre in Ireland had sent a card to the Gay Liberation Radio Collective.
Hirschfeld as in Magnus Hirschfeld.
Well, I imagine that's who it was named after, Magnus Hirschfeld. There was also stuff about the March on Washington for Gay Rights. There was a pamphlet on that from 1979, the original pamphlet, which is sort of fairly historical.
That's very historical.
I managed to scan that and stick a copy on my phone, I think. But so there's all sorts of stuff. We'd get stuff from the International Gay Association. We'd also try and keep in tabs with other gay programmers on other stations as they started producing gay radio programs. So, yeah.
Cool. I think that's all I have. Is there anything else you wanted to say?
Oh, no, there's probably a lot to talk about. I need to go through stuff to jog my memory from things going way, way back then. But, hopefully I've tried to cover some of the stuff.
Yeah, you did great. Thank you so much for taking a journey with me. It's been really special.
I'm Simona Castricum, and you're listening to 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM.
Rainbow United is a self-advocacy group that is run by and for LGBTQIA+ adults with intellectual disabilities and acquired brain injuries in Victoria. We get together online to fight for our rights, be in community, and support each other. We meet fortnightly on Zoom. Reach out to us by email at hello@rainbowunited.org.au. Or go to our website, rainbowunited.org.au. You're welcome in our Rainbow family. A 3CR supporter.
The new International Bookshop's Big Red Book Fair is back for 2026. We'll have thousands of secondhand books for super low prices and 20% off new books, plus many other cool things. This is a great moment to support Melbourne's longest running left bookshop. I'll see you on Saturday, the 18th of July from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at Trades Hall, 54 Victoria Street, Carlton. Can't wait to see you there. The new International Bookshop is a 3CR supporter.
ReCR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show here on 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM on the dial, streaming live on 3cr.org.au and on the Community Radio Plus app if you're out and about. And hopefully everyone is having a nice morning and staying warm. It's 45 minutes past 7 in the morning. And we were just speaking with Mark Meager, who was an early presenter of the Gay Liberation Program from 1978. Sorry, the Gay Liberation Program here on 3CR in 1978 to 1985, as well as a member of 3CR's Committee of Management and a vice chairperson of the Community Radio Federation. And we were speaking about his involvement in 3CR, gay and queer political activism, both during the 80s and now, and what life was like for Mark as a gay man during the 80s. Speaking of which, we are going to now hear an archival episode of the Gay Liberation Program, which originally aired on the 19th of September 1979. which features a conversation between Mark Meagher himself with Grant, Dave, and a young Alison Thorne of Thorne Harbour Health, who were at the time part of an organisation called the Young Gays. They're obviously speaking about being young and gay, so this first half contains a conversation about these three gay people coming out to their parents. And just a quick note to listeners that this audio contains language which may be considered derogatory towards queer people, and at the time was maybe also considered derogatory towards queer people. Anyway, here is the first half.
Really, one of the biggest things about being young and gay is first working out that you're not straight like you think the rest of the world is and deciding to do something about it. What did you, as young gays, do about it?
Well, I first decided when I was about 16 that after all this time of thinking that I might be gay, that I probably was. So I first thing I started doing was I stopped going out with girls. And then when I got to about 17, I decided I wanted to do something a bit more positive, so I decided I'd write to a few places, and I wrote off to a couple of organisations, and the letter was returned because they didn't exist anymore or anything. And then I finally wrote when I just turned 18, and I wrote off to Society 5, which is one of Melbourne's, well, was one of Melbourne's largest gay organisations, and nothing happened for a while, and then eventually my letter was answered from a member of Society 5, and I finished up actually going to see this guy, and we talked, and I saw him quite a bit, and I said I wanted to meet a lot of gay people, so I went along to Society 5 a couple of times, but decided I really didn't like it, and realised that it wasn't really sort of my scene, I suppose you could say, and I didn't really want to be there, so I was sort of faced with the problem again of finding like another venue, I suppose you could say, of gay people, and then for a while I didn't have anything, and then I just started meeting up with a few gay people, and so here I am.
How did you manage to meet up with gay people?
Well, I had a relationship with the guy I met from Society 5. I might talk about that a little bit later when we talk about older gays being predatory.
Actually, it's interesting the way that you should talk about that, Grant, because for me that was really quite different. When I thought to myself that possibly I was a lesbian, that was when I was 14. I was had a school holiday job working in a factory, and there was this beautiful Lebanese woman working there. Her name was Yasmin. She was so beautiful. I was just infatuated by her. And all I wanted to do was sit and eat my lunch with her. And I thought to myself, heavens, maybe I'm a lesbian. And then I thought, oh, Alison, don't be so ridiculous. So my reaction to that was to go out with as many men as possible. And I found these relationships very unsatisfying, and it wasn't, in fact, until I was 18 that I did anything more about it. And that was purely by accident when I had a relationship with another woman who was living in college with me at university. And since then, I haven't really looked back, and I've been coming out ever since. And I've only recently just come out to my mother, which was, I feel, a very important step. Her reaction was a little bit negative. It wasn't as bad as I thought it could possibly have been. She said that she was already a little bit suspicious, and that she was aware of the fact that my sexual preferences had changed. But she felt that it was only just a phase, which is a very negative reaction that a lot of us have to face.
Well, I came out in one of Australia's smaller provincial cities, and I feel that that created a whole host of new problems for me, as opposed to those that Alison and Grant probably faced in coming out in a big city. Namely, that a small city, there was a lot of pressure from the people around me, and there were only very few places for a young gay to have an outlet at all. And by merely partaking in any gay activities, you're immediately incriminating yourself quite openly to the whole community. And so I was very reluctant to come out at all, and finally had to succumb to the pressure and leave that city, which is a terrible situation to be in. But I find Melbourne as a city far better to live in, and the problems sort of seem to be negligible since I've come here.
When I was at school, constantly, as far back as I can remember, I was always called a poofter or a sissy or something like that. And although I really wasn't sure about my feelings, I just had them, and I thought, well, I know everybody has to go through this anyway. But it was quite annoying, and it really started to worry me when I got to about fourth form. I really was beginning to start thinking seriously that I may be gay, and that's when being called a poofter was really hurting, because I knew it may be true, whereas before it didn't seem that it might be. And I just lay low and sort of took it all, and come HSC it sort of died down a little bit, and there was hardly any worries about it at all. Nobody seemed to be worried or even interested in calling anybody anything, because they were too sort of busy with their studies. But all through school, it's pretty disastrous. It's not nice.
Something that concerns every young gay person is relating to their parents. Either they feel they can't tell their parents, or they have told their parents and their parents have problems coping with it. I think this is one area that we should really discuss. We have problems coping with our sexuality. Our parents do too.
I think a lot of us also are financially dependent upon our parents. I'm fortunate in the fact that I have a part-time job, but I know that if I'd been financially dependent upon my mother, that I certainly wouldn't have told her. And I wasn't game to come out and say, look, Mum, I'm gay, until I knew that there was nothing that she could really do that could really bother me.
Yeah, I had a similar problem in the sense that I was really worried that if my father found out, that he might cut off all my allowances, but that's not relevant anymore because I'm totally independent. But it was really quite a concern for a while. I wasn't worried about my mother, because she knew anyway, but I just thought, if my father finds out, everything's just going to be terrible.
That seems to be fairly standard, because I had the same experiences, concern for my well-being and money first.
I'm also the sort of person that really needs the approval of my mother. Being the oldest child in the family and having younger brothers and sisters, I felt that if I came out and said that I was gay, that my mother might refuse me access to my younger brothers and sisters, who I really get on well with and like to do a lot of things with. Also, I'm involved with a youth group as well, and I felt that if I came out to too many people, that once again, that my activities in that sort of area would be curtailed.
I'd just like to talk a little bit about actually coming out to your parents. As far as I know, my father doesn't know. My mother does know. She actually found out a couple of letters I sent off to organisations that were returned to me, the second one of which was entitled CAMP, meaning Campaign Against Moral Persecution, and she opened the letter, which I strongly objected to, but when she actually sat down and said, well, are you? I said, well, I'm glad you opened the letter, because I really wanted to tell you, but I didn't know how to go about it. But at that stage, I hadn't had any sexual experiences, but I still was pretty sure of my feelings, because I knew that women just had sort of no sexual... they just didn't appear attractive at all sexually to me. And so for me to actually say to her yes, it was very hard, because I hadn't actually had any relationships. And she said to me, well, it's probably just a phase you're going through. And I said, well, I don't think so, but I'm sure that she probably thought so. And for quite a while, she still did. And even about 6 months ago, I rang up a friend. I was at home visiting my parents, and I rang up a friend to ask her if she wanted to come out. And my brother-in-law was there, and my mother turned and said to him, I'll just call him Rudy, you know, Rudy or Valentino the playboy, and I was so furious, but I realised at that time that it was really hard for my mother to accept it, and that I wasn't going to bring it up anymore unless she wanted to talk about it, because she just, perhaps she just didn't want to know, or she didn't understand, or what, I don't know.
That's right. I think that actually bringing up the topic of the fact of your sexuality is something that's very difficult to do, because whether you're straight or whether you're gay, sexuality is something that you very rarely talk about with your parents.
Unless they ask you.
That's right. And my mother didn't actually ask me, but as she was saying, I know you're up to your eyeballs in something, so I thought it was a good opportunity to tell her. She'd heard me involved with some of the organisation for the conference, talking to people on the telephone, and she knew I was up to something, so I thought in view of that it was in fact a good time to tell her, rather than waiting until her suspicions had died down again. I think that the main reason why I wanted to tell my mother was so that there would no longer be the pressure on me. There is a lot of pressure from parents. Why aren't you going out with boys, or why aren't you going out with girls, and so on. And I think it's really wonderful if you can be quite open with your parents. If I can go home to my mother's place and take my girlfriend with me, I think that this is something that is really beneficial.
I have a problem now where I just can't lie to my parents, and so it's better for me not to talk about it at all, because I know I'm going to finish up lying. But my mother sort of has this problem where she hates knowing anything that my father doesn't know, and I realise that she's been placed in this sort of bind of a situation at the moment, and I don't really know how she manages it.
Yeah, what is that about? Sort of, yeah, your parents don't speak about it unless you want to speak about it to them. I think basically why I told my parents is because I didn't want to live a lie. I didn't want to have to sort of live a double life. That wasn't on for me as a person. But I also found that when I did tell my parents, that the first reaction they had was that they didn't really want to talk about it. That was something that they wanted to try and overlook. How did you find that?
Well, my mother certainly hasn't broached the topic. I only came out to her last week, and since the actual coming out session, she hasn't mentioned the fact at all. It's almost as if she's blocked it from her mind.
Just that business before about why aren't you going out with boys, etc. I'm lucky in the respect that I do go out with a lot of women, and so when I am home at my parents' place, you know, I'm quite often talking about somebody that I've gone out with, and so for my father, it's probably, you know, he may not even suspect it, because he knows I'm going out with so many different women, and he seems to think I'm some sort of a playboy, I think, anyway.
Well, I go out with a lot of men, but my mother still seems to be able to tell the difference. She always says, is he a friend or is he a friend? And if I lie to her, she can always tell. She says I react to them differently.
One thing that we haven't mentioned is the fear that many of us might have, the fear that our parents have that we will be gay. And perhaps they've mentioned to us in conversation earlier in life their attitudes towards gay people. I know that my parents have mentioned to me earlier that they thought that it was a state that could be corrected by psychiatry. And so when I finally realised that I was actually gay, I knew what their reaction was going to be, that they were sort of going to say, yes, dear, that's fine, but let's shuffle you along to a psychiatrist and that'll be fine. That's a really big pressure that a lot of us suffer.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show here on 3CR Community Radio. We're currently listening to some archival audio from the 19th of September 1979, provided to us by Mark Meager, who's the former host of the Gay Liberation Program, which this audio came from. The episode features a conversation with Grant, Dave, and Allison, who are part of a group known as the Young Gays. Allison, it's a young Allison Thorne of Thorne Harbour Health. The second half of this conversation talks about differences in social attitudes of this group of young gay people and their elder counterparts in the community, and building solidarity between both.
Older gays, I mean perhaps 30 plus, and most of them that I have met seem just interested in sex, and they really don't seem interested in anything else. I mean, it's all I suppose, this business about supposedly being young and spunky, I don't know, but it's really, it doesn't leave you feeling much of a person. And the first relationship I had was with a guy who was, he was 27, I was 18, and he admitted to me after a while that his interests were purely sexual, and then he said, I'd like to have a serious relationship with you, and I just, I almost laughed, and I just said, no way, it won't work. I said, how could it? Just interested in sex. And I really haven't met many older gays who are genuinely interested. I met one recently, but, you know, that's one out of a million. They just don't really, well, I haven't come across them. Where are they?
Well, I feel that that could be a byproduct of the kind of pressure that older gays have suffered in the past. I keep using this word pressure, but there is a lot of pressure on gay people. They've been forced into bar scenes and that kind of life, beats, and they've just become like that. They've become conditioned toward that. I've had the experience of meeting a lot of older gays who just aren't like that at all.
I find it very difficult to meet other lesbians around about my own age, except for my first relationship, which was with somebody of my own age. I found that all of my lovers since then have been at least 5 and nearly always 10 or more years my senior, and I find that really interesting. I think, why does it always happen that way, and why don't I meet people my own age? And sometimes, even though I'm happy in my relationships, sometimes I wish that perhaps I could have a relationship with somebody my own age.
But the statistics will change as you become older. The statistics will reverse. I really don't think it's that much of an important issue.
Maybe not. Maybe we're just being ageist in saying things like that. But I do sometimes wonder to myself, why is it that every time I do meet a woman who does take an interest in me, who does say, what are you doing next week, that it always turns out that she's always 10 years or more older than me?
One thing that does annoy me greatly about the older gays, to some extent, is that many of them, yeah, they sort of do tend to be predatory. Many times I've met older gay men, I've been asked if I'd like to go back to their house for a coffee or a drink. Sure, that would be fine if it was a coffee or drink. When I was younger, I really sort of felt that it was a coffee or a drink. When I got there, I found out it wasn't. Well, out of all of that, the point that I'm really trying to make is that I would just like greater honesty. I mean, when I've met these people, I've been probably quite aware, I have been quite aware that they're gay. They've been quite aware that I'm gay. The point is, I just like greater honesty. For them to say, would you like to come and stay the night, rather than to say, would you like a drink, and that dishonesty. And that's where the young gay group can really help. It's going to change the socialising that gays have gone through before.
Yes, that was one of the extremely important things that came out of the 5th National Homosexual Conference. A workshop was held for young gays when we got together and we discussed some of the very problems that we've been talking about tonight. We realised that what was really needed was a group for young gays, and a meeting has been called, which will be held next Saturday, which is Saturday the 22nd of September, at the Graduate Lounge, Union House, Melbourne University, and that meeting will be at 1 p.m. in the afternoon, and that meeting will be for anybody who considers themselves a young gay.
Yeah, I don't really know. We haven't really decided like the aims and objectives of this group, but we can do this when the group actually comes together. But it may just be it'll be more comforting to be able to sit down and talk about being young and gay and the problems, if there are any, that we are going through. And, you know, we probably will organise social occasions, I'm sure, but it'll just be nice to have a group of all young gays. And we have no age stipulation on this, just anybody who feels that they're a young gay. And we have actually got members who are, potential members who are under 18. Unfortunately, there's none here today. But I hope we can be give them a lot of support about being underage.
Actually, Grant, one of the most important things that I see about the group is I think it's going to be a very important group for developing our confidence, because quite often, as a young gay, I go along to meetings of politically active groups, other gay groups that are already established around Melbourne, and I find it very difficult to get used to the meeting procedure that these groups pursue. I find that I have difficulty understanding a lot of the terms. I find I have difficulty relating to a lot of the well-seasoned political gay activists that have been around for years and years and years. And I find that quite often I get enthusiastic and I think, oh yes, I'd like to get involved with that project. And I find there always seems to be somebody who's been there and done it before, somebody who can do the job better than I can. And I think that will be very, very important in the young gay group, in that there won't be older people there to be the leaders, people who've done it before. There'll only be us, there'll only be the young gays, there'll only be the people who haven't done it before. We can flounder around, we can make our own mistakes, and we can learn from our own inexperience. And I think that this is extremely beneficial.
Yeah, basically we're just going to be very, very supportive, aren't we? A supportive group, but with sort of objectives and aims at the same time.
Yes, of course all this will come out of the first meeting, but the way I see it is I feel that we should be a social group, which is very important because of the fact that a lot of young gays can't go to the traditional venues that older gays go to. They can't go to bars because, in fact, they're underage and the licensing laws. So I think if we can run dances, barbecues, have picnics, have parties and things like that for young gays, that will be very good. I also think that we can help each other when we're facing coming out, problems with parents, problems at school. I think to sit around and talk about these things will be extremely beneficial. And I also think that it is important to raise the political awareness of young gays. We're going to be the future generation, the people who are going to have to work on problems such as law reform and discrimination in employment and education. And I think it's important that we know about these things. And I think that if we can be in a group where we're all a little bit in the dark about it and we can get people to come along and speak to us, I think that this will be really, really good. And we won't have the traditional elite that many of Melbourne's gay groups already have. I envisage that gay youth should be a group that doesn't have leaders, that doesn't have the group of people that dominate.
Yeah, that point you brought up about belonging to groups where everybody seems so much older and more experienced, well, I know you are, and I am involved in a group also that most of the people are over 30, and it does seem very difficult sometimes. I find myself sitting and listening most of the time. I've only just sort of recently got really involved in the group by partaking in the secretary bit of the group, and I'm getting more sort of awareness of what exactly is going on, and I'm understanding a lot more now. But it really is a problem being when you're quite young, and you do belong to a group that you are relevant to, and yet you find that you can't really contribute very much to it.
Yes, that's right. It's very often very hard to articulate as well, because I find that some of the terms that are thrown around I barely understand, never mind I would be unable to even use them in the correct context. And I think that within gay youth that it will be very good for us to sit down and talk about terms such as sexism, such as monogamy, such as patriarchy. I think that these sort of terms, if we can sit down and discuss them, and if we can find out what they really do mean, that this will be greatly beneficial to us all.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show here on 3CR Community Radio, and that was some archival audio from the Gay Liberation Program back in September of 1979, provided to us by Mark Meager, who, as I said before, was a former host of the Gay Liberation Program in the late 70s and early 80s. And he was speaking with Grant, Dave, and a young Alison Thorne of Thorne Harbour Health who were back then part of an organisation called the Young Gays, and they were, of course, speaking about being young and gay. We're now joined in the studio by Tom Cooper, who is chair of the residence committee of at the Inkerman Street public housing flats in St Kilda, seven of which of the buildings contain people over the age of 55. Last week, these residents began to address the building's pest problem by themselves in the face of the government's neglect of these buildings. And the organisation plans to bill the government for tools and labour required to do so. Good morning, Tom. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Rob.
Sorry, that was a bit of a long-winded intro. But thank you so much for joining us in the studio. It's really nice to have people physically in the studio so early in the morning. Why don't you start by telling our listeners about the block's pest problem?
Well, it's been an ongoing thing for a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
And we just can't seem to get on top of it because there's not a coordinated approach from the from housing. And it'd be great if everybody could have their places done at the one time and eradicate these bed bugs and cockroaches and, you know, we've got mice and different things once and for all, you know.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, of course, like logistically I feel like it makes the most sense to just do it all at once, you know, even if it was like an office, like you don't just fumigate one desk at a time, you fumigate the whole office, right? Like, I think even, like, they could figure that out.
Well, it's neglect, you know. They'd be onto it if they were really, really keen about it, because you've got people there, like, 90 years of age who are getting bed bugs for the first time in 3 years.
Mm.
It's just really sad.
How long has this been happening?
Well, I've been there 8 years.
Mm.
Yeah.
And you've had bugs, the entire time?
Well, you know, they come and go, but it messes with your mind.
Of course, absolutely.
And you feel socially isolated because you go to a friend's place and you give them bed bugs, and it's like they've got to be a good friend to stay a friend.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, like, given that they are public housing flats, it's the government's responsibility to address this, right? So how have your dealings been with the government in trying to get them to address this?
Well, one of the first things that we did as a residents' committee was to send a letter, a demand for on three things, which was, one was security. We needed 24-hour security guards, and we wanted proper maintenance, and we wanted to get rid of the bug infestations. We didn't get an acknowledgement to that letter at all. We gave them 7 working days to come back with a plan. After 3 days, the security guards appeared after years of being told, no, there's no money for security guards. So they manifested. That was good. But no word, no acknowledgement that they had received a letter or what their plans were or anything like that. So as far as the bug infestations, we decided that, okay, for certain people that are really affected badly, we'll go in and get has chem suits and look like, you know, Mr. White from Breaking Bad and go in and seal off cracks and put down spray and do different things like that.
Yeah, well, and it's obviously such an effort. I mean, 7 buildings.
Well, we've got one building where we are. There's 7 buildings in Melbourne for older people.
Oh, right.
And there's one in Albert Park, one in Kensington, yep. Flemington, and 3 others.
My mistake. I thought it was seven buildings in the block.
Yeah, just the one block.
Just
105.
Still, that's a lot of apartments to cover.
Yeah. We don't plan to do them all ourselves, us, geriatrics.
Yeah. I mean, you shouldn't have to as well, you know, given that it's the government's responsibility. Yeah, so, like, how many of you have been donning the suits and the spray?
Oh, there's been three of us that have got togged up.
Wow. And, of course, you're sending the bill to... you're sending the bill for the government, for their labour and tools to the government.
Yeah. See how they go with that.
I mean, they're fine to pay Israel. They're fine to pay Homes Victoria, you know, but they're not fine to pay residents to look after buildings that they should be, like, looking after themselves.
Yeah, true.
Yeah. So...
So we've got a couple, there's a couple of people I know that are very badly affected by bed bug bites. If they get them, one fellow went to hospital, he was almost died, it was chronic poisoning, and another fellow, incredible scars on his legs, you know, it's like just terrible. So it affects different people to different degrees, and it just drives people to distraction. But this combined with the threat of the buildings being torn down for no good reason at all that's been given to us, it adds to the stress. It just builds and builds. And a lot of people are suspicious that it seems to be a policy, intentional, to get people to fall out of love with the building and be more malleable to being relocated. Who knows where?
Mm. Yeah, and I think that's a very important note that, you know, everyone in the building is over the age of 55. And like you said, some people are in their 90s and are older than the building themselves.
Yeah, I'm older than the building. The building's only 60 years old.
Yeah, well.
It's about the same age as the Sydney Opera House, I believe.
Which is still standing fine.
Yeah.
That's been looked after this whole time.
Yeah.
So, yeah, maybe you'd like to talk to me a little bit more about... So, you announced that you were, you know, putting on the suits last week, right? Have they contacted you since then, the government?
No.
Yeah.
Not a peep.
Not a peep.
No, it just... All they're interested in is getting people out of there, whereas, and they tell fibs as far as, you know, the figures go, that they try to make out that there's 70 or 80% of people are happy to go, whereas we've seen very clearly that's the other way around.
Mm.
Maybe 20% might be happy to go, but 80% want to stay, definitely, you know, it's... Yep. Where they've lived for a long time, they've got their communities, they've got all their amenities, everything's fine to stay there. It's great, you know, that's a home for life, you know.
Yeah. And we were speaking off air before this about how there is a reasonable sized Russian community in the building that you live in. How have they approached the language barrier with that?
Well, we've got a fabulous Russian translator in Nika.
Yeah. And luckily that they're on your side as well, instead of saying it from a government perspective, you know, because imagine if they were someone from the Victorian government came and, you know, told these people in Russian that 80% of people want to leave and you should be leaving too, you know.
Well, I wouldn't be able to know what they were saying.
Exactly, yeah. And that's the issue, right?
But no, the Russian residents are very keen to stay. But it's understandable that there can be some confusion, you know, and they don't want to be sort of left behind. But if all the problems are dealt with, you know, things like the maintenance is done properly, if the building's looked after the way it should be, and security's doing their job of keeping the peace and keeping things, making sure that the right people are in the building, the people are supposed to be in the building are in the building, and the bugs are under control and all that. And I mean, the silver lining for this whole program has been that we've got to know each other, so much better than we knew before. We just pass each other in the lifts or at the letterbox or at the front door or something like that. But now you get to engage with people and organise, and it's beautiful. You know, we're just developing friendships more and more and more. And even amongst the Russian people, there's people who've got to know each other and seen each other and been in each other's flats for the first time in 10 or 20 years.
Even though they've been living in the same building for decades.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, that's the beauty of public housing, right? And that's why it's, to me, that's so alluring, right?
That's people from
all walks of life can live in these same buildings and...
That's the possibility,
Rob. Be in community, but...
Because last week, we had a big music event, and then last week we had a lovely lunch where we had a big borscht soup special for the Russian people, and I thought, geez, I hope they're not sick of borscht. And I hope it doesn't bring back any bad memories and associations with it. That's all they had to eat. But no, they loved it, and it was really, really well cooked by Vivian, and she's a fantastic cook.
So talk to me a little bit more about like the campaign to, of course, get them to address the building's pest problem, but also just to, in general, just to get them to realize that a majority of the residents want to actually stay in the building. Like, what does that actually look like?
Well, the first thing that we did was have a petition to see who wanted to stay and who wanted to go. Mm. And it was a clear majority of people, super majority of people wanted to stay. So that's the petition to the minister. And then we had an election for the residents committee. And so we meet every Monday. And then it was like, okay, what's the next thing? We sent this letter off, letter of demand, no response. Okay, boom. And now we're talking about it. It's out there on the airwaves. It's on social media and what have you. We're not engaging with the relocation process because it hasn't been shown to be honest and true. That they haven't been respectful, and in Parliament, it was found that they'd used coercive tactics in the past on other towers, other programs of relocation. And they haven't given us a good reason why the building has to come down. So until we get that, we're not going to engage in it. And we don't want to be in the position where people are individually picked off and pushed. And, you know, one of our residents who was happy to stay, but then he said, oh, no, he'll go. And he moved to the next suburb on the promise that that would be, it would be able to stay there for a long time. You know, he gets there. Oh, and he's told, no, this place is going to be pulled down in 2 years. So he just said, she lied to me.
Yeah.
She tricked me. So that's, we've got, declarations of non-cooperation on the doors of about 50%, 51-52% of the residents on the doors there that say, don't contact me by phone, letter, email, or at the door. If you want to contact me, get in touch with me through the residents committee email. And still, we keep getting letters in the mail. So you can put on there, like, return to sender to Homes Victoria, and do as you're told, and only contact me through the residents committee.
Yep. Just for listeners' notes who can't see what I'm physically seeing, Tom is holding a letter from Homes Victoria with the words return to sender, do as you are told and only contact me through the residence committee. It'd be interesting to see how they react to that. I mean, especially if they're not really even acknowledging the problems that you are raising to them, that they, I guess in my view, in a normal person's view would say, like, you're the landlord of the building, you're responsible for everything that goes wrong, right? It'd be interesting to see how they do that, and hopefully it doesn't get too messy. Well, I mean, it probably will. It already is messy. So.
Well, there's millions and billions of dollars tied in with this, you know, big build.
Yeah.
So some people have got some big vested interests in it, but we're the people who are living there, and we've got more invested in it. This is our lives. You know, they're talking about money and figures in their accounts, but this is people's lives and communities, and communities are so important to staying alive.
Absolutely. Especially, it just seems so, like, I mean, I you know, I assume that, like, a majority of the people in the building are not working, right? Mm. So, like, you have a lot of time to organize around this, you know? It seems quite silly, like, you're not working, you're organizing community, and that's... seems like a very tactical mistake for the Victorian government, right?
Well, we're lucky that they didn't go gung-ho full bore right off the bat. You know, they gave us plenty of time this time. The first one, the towers that went down, it was very, very quick thing. No one was organised like this. But now we've got a majority of residents at Inkerman Street, St Kilda, in Albert Park, in Kensington and in Flemington, and that,
awesome.
And they're also organizing in the other.
Wow.
So it's, big majority of people, and you can't, get cattle trucks and move people out, you know, en masse to, I don't know, out in Melbourne.
It's scary to think what would happen. We've just got 2 minutes left of the show, so maybe I'll just leave it here. But thank you so much for coming into the show. And maybe you just want to quickly tell our listeners, like, maybe how they can support the campaign and get behind this. Like, should people come to the residents' committee meetings, or is there, like, a little thing they should sign? Or just to follow the Instagram is the best way. Yeah, cool. Sweet. I can put a little, and they can join as members
to
44 Flats United. Yeah, cool. Yeah. We can put all of that in the little podcast notes for the show that we publish.
Thanks, Rob.
But yeah, thank you so much for coming into the studio, and
welcome all support.
Best of luck with the campaign. You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show. We just have a minute left of the show. I was just speaking to Tom Cooper, who's the chair of the residence committee of the Inkerman Street public housing flats in St Kilda, where residents have taken it upon themselves to remove pests, including bed bugs, in the building, despite the government's neglect. We also heard on a show, archival audio from 1979, about being young and gay from the Gay Liberation Program. And we also spoke with Mark Meager, who was an early presenter of the program from 1978 to 1985. Stay tuned for Women on the Line. We'll see you next week.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.